So from one angle, nothing is easier than being here and now with an open heart. Be here now and respond to what comes forward. On the other hand, from another angle, this is the hardest work that anybody could possibly do. Anybody who's spent an hour on the meditation cushion or spent a week in a meditation retreat knows this firsthand. In a way, this spiritual practice, training in presence and openness, is the hardest and most challenging thing you could possibly do. All the habits in our genes, the attitude pervading our culture, kind of a flavor of despair and complacency that you almost have to battle against to keep your head above that water. There's so many ways to dwindle a life in entertainment and shallow pursuits. You read about this phenomena in Asia about children who teenagers or moving into their 20s who do not leave the house at all, but they spend their whole life on the internet playing video games. They just order take-in food. There's so much suffering to behold and embrace. Most of us, our minds have been trained for decades in denial, turning away from our own experience, in distraction, in unending inner dialogue. So from this perspective, seeing just how hard real, thoroughgoing spiritual practice is, we really need help. At least I can say, I really need help. And we need all the help we can get. So if we want to ripen the fruits of this practice, we have to become students. And I want to talk about becoming a student, first of all, in a broad way, because it's not just about the teacher-student relationship to human beings. So what is a student in the context of Dharma? I tried to break it into two gates today. So the first gate is, I called the gate of humility. The gate of humility. So in becoming a true student of Dharma, the first practice is to recognize that there's much more to this life than meets the eye. There's much more to our own mind than we are seeing. It's an admission that I have blind spots. It's an admission that by just the very nature of being a human being who sees from a particular time-space coordinate with a particular background of conditioning in a particular cultural nexus, my vision of the way things are and who I am is limited. And because that's just the situation, I need help to see beyond that. The gate of humility means I have to be a little bit frustrated with my own dysfunction. I have to be able to say it's true that I perpetually fall into the same dark pits in my life. I get caught in the same habits. I get entangled in the same way in relationships. There's areas of my life and emotions I've not been able to clarify of my own efforts. It's just the way it is. We have to admit that I don't know all there is to know. And especially when it comes to the truths of the Dharma, the kind of teachings we read, that I don't have extensive experience of it. There's much that I could touch that I'm not able to on my own. So what we're doing here, and I like the image of a gate because a gate can be closed, but we have to open it. The gate of humility is continually stepping into the place of our hearts that is open and has room available for input. Room available in the heart-mind for feedback. Room available for a fresh perspective. Because I could keep it closed. We all are that person at times. We all know people who are that person at times. We've certainly have this experience of having some authority or direct experience of something and somebody else who could actually really use the information being totally closed to it. And the key thing is to notice when we're in the place of closure and to investigate why. First of all, learning to feel it. Can I feel when I'm in that place of closure? Why am I closing the gates on the input of life? What's at stake here? Feeling that closure and then learning to open it in a way that's zazen. So I want to unpack this particular principle some more. So, like I said, I've worked with Hogan and Chosen for about 12 years, and I must have had hundreds of private interviews. And if you've not had Sanzen, Dokusan, private interview, it's a brief encounter where you go into the teacher, you do a couple of bows, and you have an interaction. And you may present your state of mind, you may have a question, but at that point, it's their role to offer some kind of teaching, or to be a mirror to one's state of mind. So now that I've done this practice for a really long time, I can look back and have some memory of how I used to do it and get a kind of catch a glimpse of who I used to be in that room. And I can say with all honesty, it is extremely difficult to allow teaching in. Very hard to really be in the place of being a student. How often do I hear a practice instruction that's coming from 20, 30, 40 years of experience? I hear it, and if not at the time, but right after I leave the room, my mind says, yes, but. Yeah, that might be true, but X, Y, Z, A, B, C, here's why I'm not going to do what you told me. Here's how I know better. How often do I, with a teacher or somebody who has some knowledge of something I think I would like to learn, actually maneuver the conversation, this is an interesting one to catch, so as to avoid direct feedback? How rare is it that we actually make ourselves receptive to deep feedback? You see the interesting, I don't know what you would call it. It's almost like a short circuit, a break in the circuit in human desire. We want to wake up. We want to be free. We do want to reduce our suffering, but when the teaching comes or when the medicine comes, it's often bitter, and we'll do anything to escape and turn away from it. How often do I take a teaching in, take it to heart, and contemplate it at length? Saying, how much value do I actually place in the teaching I receive and actualize it through reflection, through taking it seriously? So being a student is actually a lifelong practice. You know, it's not like we just get it, especially in the spiritual realm. It's a new way of being. It's not the same. This is not just a transmission of information. It's not just a communication of data and facts. It's much more than that. So this is a practice. Now, it is a practice with a human teacher, but it's also not just that. You know, a human teacher is a catalyst, and I think an accelerator of spiritual growth. The Buddha had numerous teachers before he taught. He made it a point to go around India and study with the most accomplished meditation teachers, the most accomplished contemplatives of his time. And then when he learned what he thought he could learn and really did his best to be the best student he could, in fact, his teachers asked him to take over their communities. And he said, no, I have more. I learned what I could from you, but I need to go on. I have more to learn. So I feel at some point we have to commit to working with an actual living human being if we want our spiritual life to flower at some time or another. Or else we will never exit the realm of our own self-imposed limitations. We will not be able to see and become free of our own blind spots. So the human teacher is so, so important. And yet, the gate of humility or the mind of student means being receptive to teaching from all directions. All directions, from all many, many sources. It's an ongoing work. And in a way, you could say this is the work of Zazen, softening the mind that knows so much and letting the lessons from our day-to-day living come in and to penetrate. Now, Dharma vision is the key. What we're learning is to let go of the three poisons, greed, anger, and ignorance, learning to see the dreamlike nature of things, learning to see oneness and the subtle interconnections that are always happening, but we usually don't notice. So, and I find this continually even more striking, this particular principle. The more continual the practice of awakeness in your life, bringing that into whatever activity, no excuses, the more allies and teachers come forward with their particular gifts to help wake us up. Often when I'm in retreat, there's almost a shamanic quality about it. So I'm intent on being really continually awake and concentrated and letting go of my stuff, opening up. And I'll find that I'm daydreaming and I'm starting to get drawn into one of those really kind of sticky thought trains of resentment or lust or whatever it may be. And then all of a sudden there'll be a loud caw, caw, or it'll start raining, or I'll stub my toe. That often happens. I run into something. And I take that as the feedback of the Dharma, that the whole world, because it's not separate from our mind, when we have this aspiration to transform, actually begins to work with us if we're open. The people in our lives, they turn from being a source of annoyance, somebody who doesn't know anything, or someone who gets in the way. We actually begin to see this person, of all the billions and millions of people I could have ended up in a classroom or a spiritual community or a sangha or a workplace with, it's these people. And there's something they have to teach me, every single one of them. Teach me to let go of something. Give me an opportunity to offer something. There's always something there, especially in more long-term relationships. So the dance of yin and yang comes to mind. Most people are probably familiar with the principle of yin and yang from Chinese thinking. So yin is sometimes associated with the feminine. So yin is the quality of yielding, of openness, of receptivity. Yin is the energy of inviting in. And so we need to learn to sense when we're in this place, to know the quality. Yang is the energy of leading, of acting, of creating, of bringing forth. You might think of it as the active power position. Now, as adults, I'm sure all of us have so much responsibility and duties and people that we have to take care of. We're habituated to the yang energy style, always moving towards, always making happen, always, if not most of the time, relying on our own agency. We can't call mommy anymore and have her pay the bills. We can't rely on someone else to take care of what we need to take care of all the time. This is good, this is healthy, and this is appropriate. But as Dharma students, one of the practices is to learn when we are in that energy and to learn to release it, to release that kind of active principle of being the one who knows and who's in charge, and to shift into the space of yin, the space of receiving, the soft student heart mind. Now, there's two points here. First one is this is a moment-by-moment dance. So there's a phrase that Zen training is learning to turn on a dime, learning to turn on a dime, flexibility, dancing with impermanence. So in my experience at the monastery, we have perhaps an enhanced experience of dancing with roles and the yin and yang energy, especially as you've been there for a while. So one example for me is in the morning before meditation, I need to take my partner's feedback about whatever. Because she knows me so well that she has a very potent vantage point on my situation and on my particular stuckness or dilemma. So I need to learn to be receptive to her, whether I like it or not. So in one moment, I'm receptive and letting in feedback. And the next, she asks me feedback about cooking the daily meal, because I was the tenzo for more than 2 years, and she's now the head cook, and I have a lot of experience doing that. So she is able to drop the one who gives feedback, and then we switch roles. There's the dance right there. I'm now in the position where it's important for me to offer whatever I can offer. Then I go into the morning meditation round, and then the first thing I do is I sit down. A few minutes later, I go to interview with Chosen Roshi. And I enter the interview room with Chosen Roshi, and I sit down, and the part of the practice of Sanzen, or private interview, is to sit in your own skin and present your experience with confidence. Say, this is who I am in this moment, and this is what I'm experiencing. But then, right after that, I do that, I need to be able to drop that, and then to be open to what she has to say so she can teach. Because for it to be possible for there to be a communication of Dharma, I have to be able to yield and to open up and to move into the place of not knowing. It wouldn't do for me to step in the room in a kind of woe is me, I'm a pitiful human being, I know nothing space. That's not the point. Step in with confidence and then be able to shift into receptivity. So then I leave the interview room, and the very next thing I do is I go and I begin seeing beginning students in interview. And it's my job, first of all, to receive them, to receive their state of mind, step into that space of openness. And then I step into the space of where I give teaching. So it's a back and forth, a movement from giving and receiving, giving and receiving. It's a dance, an ongoing dance. Now, yes, there is a place where receptivity and expression, they're not ultimately separate. They're not some fixed duality. And yet, how do we learn that? How do we learn to really know each of them? Well, I think we learn each of them by coming to know the flavor of each of them very well. So there was a time where I was doing interview where I could just feel that I was going in completely resistant to whatever was going to be said. I was already kind of gritting my teeth and already, at the heart level, I was close to what was going to be said, partially because it was cutting to the bone. It was really a potent thing, and I was afraid to hear it. It was not comfortable. And so during that time, it was a time for me to really work on just receiving. Or if I get the feedback in my life that somebody feels they're not being heard, I need to let that in and see how much am I able to drop and be a student of this person, and how much am I in a dominant space of really being the one who knows. So the teacher and student is not a fixed thing. Teacher and student co-arise. It's a continual dance. There's that old phrase, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. And actually a very, very potent koan. When the student is ready, the teacher appears. How would you work by that moment by moment? Not thinking that, oh, when I finally get my life all in order and I have time to meditate, some great guru is going to knock on my door or give a talk at People's Co-op, and then I'll meet him, and there'll be light and love, and he'll give me a darshan, and whoop! It's a little bit more subtle than that. You could also flip it around. When the teacher is ready, the student appears. This is a very important principle. We're always practicing together. We're always teaching each other. It's just a matter of the particular seat we're in. But teacher and student, they're not separate. So if we're working with a human teacher, and in a way we're always working with a human teacher, we can take the view that it is our privilege to empower the wisdom of the teacher. They can't be a teacher if we don't come forward as a student. We give them the space to do their thing. See how that works? A teacher could be brilliant. In fact, you know, back to the Buddha's enlightenment, he arose off the seat of his awakening, and the first people who saw him just thought he was this emaciated bum. And they didn't want to have anything to do with him. They weren't willing to hear what he had to say because They just didn't have the eye to see the value of this person. But then there were people who did have the mind of a student, and they saw right away that this person has something to teach me. So the more space we can give, the more the teacher is empowered, and the more we are empowered. Some communication can actually take place. Of course, the teaching is flowing both ways. It's almost 8:40. Is this a good place to stop, or should I continue? Yeah. Any questions? See, Jeff and then Caitlin.
Earlier in the talk, you mentioned working with a teacher in the context of lay practice. Could you share any thoughts on that? Things you learned?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I am so prone to confusion that I recognize right away the value of working with a teacher. Partially as the function of reorienting to me to what I really valued, because I forget that so easy. So especially outside of the monastery, there's so many things that pull up my attention that the teacher's role at first especially was to remind me of my deepest aspiration, because they were really in touch with it and embodying it. And that's their job. It's their job to say, practice. So I think because we're pulled in so many ways that is really important to have the teacher to remind us. Yeah. That's a major function for me. Meditation is not something, the practice of meditation is utterly simple. The territory of meditation is incredibly complex, wild, and full of pitfalls. So whether you're a layperson, you're a monk, whether you live in retreat, or you're a busy householder, it's not possible to tutor oneself in the path of meditation. There has to be some source of feedback. And so really valuing that, especially when I went in sabbatical and left the monastery and was living as a layperson, I knew I needed that, in a way, it's still reorientation. Go a few degrees this way, because you're going a few degrees that way, and there's a ditch over there. Well, for one thing, he can't get up here and say, it'd be good if students were really receptive to the teaching. What's that? Or maybe he couldn't say it as directly as I did. Yeah. I want to get into, I don't think tonight's the night, but I want to get into the more psychological and emotional and nitty-gritty dynamics of working with a teacher, because I've done it for a long time. And maybe I think part two will need to happen. And that might be something that would be better for me to do than him. So. Because this, it is not a relationship that is love, light, and continual, unwavering continuum of comfort. It is a relationship that will be difficult if you really engage it, will have ups and downs, will challenge you, both challenge the teacher and challenge the student. So. It's a good place to stop tonight. Okay. Thank you very much.